As discussed with Dr. Grothy, one of the most controversial issues in colorectal cancer is management of patients with stage 2 disease. And for another take on this critical issue, I met with Dr. Alan Vanook, who began by reviewing the Oncotype colon data just presented at the ASCO meeting.
What they presented at ASCO is really the fruits of a lot of labor in analysis of tumor specimens with outcome data in untreated stage 2 patients. What they found is that there is a genetic risk factor or risk profile that can give a rough estimate somewhere between 10 and 20% on a continuum depending on the score of what the risk of recurrence is. That is important probably at the extremes. So if you know you've got a 20% risk of recurrence, that might motivate you to take chemotherapy. If it's 10%, might not. But different people will do different things with the information. What's missing from the genomic health data set is any predictive value for these tests. So you can give a prognosis of recurrence risk, but they fail to see an ability to predict the benefit from chemotherapy at a given point in the genetic analysis, that chemotherapy being 5-FU. So some people view this as not enough. Certainly we'd like more information. The point is you can give a patient a relative risk of recurrence, but you can't necessarily quantify the benefit they'll get from chemotherapy.
Well, I thought that they actually presented the fact that the relative risk reduction was kind of the same across these risk lines. So unlike breast cancer, where you could say, well, this group has no benefit and this group has a great benefit, but they still claim to be able to predict the benefit. It's just relative risk being the same. Do you buy into that?
Well, it turns out they didn't really present the data to support that. And in fairness, they only have 10 minutes to present their data. It is true that what they would say in their complete information about the study is that the relative risk reduction, it was the same across the entire strata. And so you can apply that information. So it might go from 22 to 19, from 21 to 18. But again, that was not presented in detail, so it's harder to sort through.
You know, the whole scenario of trying to counsel a patient with lower risk disease, of course, we've been through that with breast cancer, and a lot of people with breast cancer end up getting chemotherapy even though there's relatively modest benefit. But one thing that's kind of different about adjuvant therapy in colon cancer is you have the potential to give not only less toxic therapy, you mentioned 5-FU, but also capecitabine in terms of an oral agent, which granted, you know, can have toxicities, but doesn't seem to cause hair loss, nausea and vomiting, or require an intravenous infusion. How do the discussions go when you have patients who have, you know, quote, normal risk stage 2 disease as you consider the treatment?
Well, it's a very personal, philosophical decision. It's true that women with breast cancer appear to be much more willing to take a lot of risk for a small benefit. Some of that is undoubtedly the mindset of the oncologist who may view breast cancer and colon cancer through different lenses. In my experience, most patients will come to the visit with a physician already having made their mind up they want chemotherapy or they don't. And I think that's based on their own expectations and personal philosophy. I think as oncologists, the balancing that we need to do is to accurately reflect the risks associated with chemotherapy, which are small. So the risk of death from chemotherapy is 1 in 200 for colon cancer patients, and balance that against the potential benefit. And of course, emphasize that as a population, the benefit is small, but for an individual, it may be greater. But my experience is that the patients already know what they want to do before they get to see the oncologist. And many patients, the default position is they assume they should take chemotherapy. I think, as I said, one of the other messages is that older patients may not get as much benefit from combination chemotherapy. But again, I don't think we should look at a 75-year-old who's robust any differently than a 55-year-old. So this is all personal experience and bias, and I have no doubt that different oncologists will lead patients to do different things based on their own interpretation. And frankly, I think the data is so open to interpretation that we have to live with that.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and you know, we're pretty selective about what kind of systemic issues we talk about with a surgical audience, but at the ASCO meeting in Orlando in June was presented, I think, one of the most anticipated trials, clinical trials in colorectal cancer research, which is the NSABP study C08, looking at bevacizumab or Avastin in the adjuvant setting. Can you talk a little bit about what exactly bevacizumab is and what was observed in this study?
So bevacizumab is loosely called an anti-angiogenesis agent. It's an antibody that targets vascular endothelial growth factor, which has a variety of roles. It does affect wound healing and tissue fixing over wounds. The bowel anastomosis, VEGF, clearly plays a role. So the rationale behind its use with chemotherapy is that it, amongst other things, may augment the delivery of chemotherapy to tumors, but also prevents vascularization of tumors, which tumors need to grow and become substantial metastatic deposits. Avastin has a role and is useful with many chemotherapies in a host of diseases, including colon cancer. So the idea was to combine a standard adjuvant therapy, FOLFOX, with Avastin, to use Avastin for 6 months with the chemotherapy, and then to continue for an additional 6 months, believing that if you can turn off the growth factors for an additional 6 months, you may allow the body's natural immune system to eradicate any residual cancer cells. This was an NSABP study. It included stage 2 and stage 3 patients. About 80% were stage 3. And the data is certainly, at the end of the day, one thing we can say is that this strategy, the Avastin for a year, did not change the overall outcome for patients. So at 3 years, which was the endpoint, there was no significant difference in disease-free survival. And we generally believe that that would predict that there won't be an overall survival difference based on other studies. It is important to say that it was generally well tolerated, so there were no dramatic consequences of the Avastin in terms of bowel perforation or other major wound healing issues. There was pain and a few other global symptoms. The potentially interesting finding was that if when they looked at intervals before the 3 years, so from 6 months to about a year and a half, there appeared to be a pretty substantial difference in disease-free survival between the two groups. So the patients who got Avastin appeared to have a delay in recurrence, although they may have been as likely to recur as the other patients.
And the thing that was really impressive is in the year that they were on the bevacizumab, they had 40% fewer recurrences.
Correct. The hazard ratio was 0.6 in the 6 months to a year interval. That's extremely interesting and may get at the mechanism of action that bevacizumab delays but doesn't prevent recurrence. And that may be very important. There is one technical issue which is being sorted out, and that is that it's not certain that patients in that 6 month to a year time frame were imaged, had CT scans at the same interval on both arms. Now, if they did, then this is a very significant finding. It's conceivable that patients were imaged more frequently, let's say on the no bevacizumab arm, and you're only going to find recurrences for the most part if you image patients. So there's another analysis that needs to be done of the data. But if that holds up, it certainly is provocative in terms of mechanism of action and clues to future strategies. There is another study called the AVANT trial, which I hear will have data mature by the end of the year. And that's also looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. And that'll be important to sort of complement the data from NSABP C08. For the moment, though, the NSABP C08, at the end of the day, bevacizumab did not improve survival.
And I guess there's been a big debate about, as you mentioned, it's certainly used frequently in metastatic disease, not just in colon, but also a lot of other tumors, lung, breast, et cetera, but whether or not that was going to translate into benefit in the adjuvant setting. As you say, right now, I guess any consideration of this would be only in a clinical trial setting, and they're talking about maybe, you know, depending upon the results of this other study, looking at longer durations, not sure whether that's going to happen. What about in metastatic disease? Our surveys have shown that it's the most common biologic that's used in first-line therapy. How do patients tolerate it, and how much benefit is involved?
Avastin is generally very well tolerated, although, of course, it's given with chemotherapy, so you do have the side effects of chemotherapy. The principal side effect is hypertension, which is easily controlled almost always. There's about a 4% overall risk of major events, stroke, heart attack, bowel perforation. So the majority of patients do quite well with Avastin. In colon cancer, at least, it adds benefit to every chemotherapy combination in every setting that's been tested, although in some circumstances, the benefit is appreciably less than in others. So, for example, with FOLFIRI-bevacizumab compared to FOLFIRI, there's a bigger incremental benefit in the studies that were done, as opposed to FOLFOX with or without bevacizumab, where the benefit is less. But overall, it would appear that bevacizumab, that Avastin adds to the quality and number and activity of chemotherapy almost across the board.
From the point of view of, again, a surgeon thinking about this, maybe a couple of red flags ought to go up if, in fact, for some reason, there's going to be surgery done on a patient who's receiving or recently received bevacizumab. And you mentioned the wound healing issue, also the issue about potential bowel perforation. What do we know about those two things?
Well, wound healing is definitely a concern. And anecdotally and in big collections of data, there is a small difference in the complication rate and morbidity of surgeries to the detriment with Avastin. Although the current recommendation is certainly elective surgeries should be done at least 6, maybe 8 weeks from the last dose of Avastin. Avastin has a long half-life. Its half-life is about 20 days, so you need to wait for a number of half-lives. So there is a registry that was just published. Eric Van Cutsem published it in Annals of Oncology called the BEAT, B-E-A-T registry. And that really suggests that if you wait 6 to 8 weeks, there are very few obvious issues with Avastin and wound healing and those complications. Now, having said that, a patient on Avastin who shows up to the surgeon with belly pain, you have to think quickly about a bowel perforation. Again, the risk is about 1.5% in all populations, maybe a little worse in patients with peritoneal carcinomatosis or multiple prior surgeries. Other issues that probably aren't problems, but that people talk about is liver regeneration after bevacizumab. Again, anastomotic breakdown. It's talked about, but the best I can tell, there's no evidence that Avastin really alters the healing or the recovery of the liver or the anastomosis. And the most important data set, maybe from NSABP-C08, is the absence of any bowel perforations early on. These are patients who you'd assume would be at greatest risk. By definition, they started their chemotherapy within 6 to 8 weeks of a bowel anastomosis, and yet there's no safety signal from that. I think the biggest issue, though, is for the surgeon. Let's say there's a hernia or some elective surgery that's being contemplated, is wait. Don't do it when a patient's just received Avastin, because even if it's a small risk of surgical complication, it's a risk that you shouldn't take.
Let's talk a little bit about the cases you brought in today, beginning with your 80-year-old man.
So this is a vigorous 80-year-old who's had prostate cancer surgery some years ago, has stable coronary artery disease. He's asymptomatic. He's still working, sort of a patriarch of the family, presents in that way. He has mild liver function abnormalities on a routine evaluation, no complaints, appropriately gets worked up and is found to have a solitary liver metastasis in the right lobe of the liver that is resectable. He sees a surgeon first who says, I can resect that. He has a primary sigmoid colon cancer that is asymptomatic, non-obstructing, not bleeding. He has a normal hemoglobin. And so the real issue is, what order do you do what, and what optimizes this patient's chance of being cured, because this is a curable patient. First issue in colorectal cancer is, what are the goals of therapy? In this case, it's cure. Whether he's 80 or 40, this is a curable disease. So this patient actually saw the colorectal surgeon, the hepatic surgeon, and then me to sort of weigh in with the various options.
It seems like there are a couple issues here. One is there are two sort of surgical issues out on the table, the primary and the met. But the other thing that would be an issue, even if there wasn't a primary, is this big controversy about how do you manage people who have surgically resectable liver mets in terms of do you just send them to surgery or do you give them some chemo first?
Absolutely right. And this is a really complex discussion. There are a number of correct approaches to this patient. So you could take the primary and the liver metastasis in one operation, although because of the patient's age, the feeling of our hepatic surgeon was that that was probably more of an operation than was appropriate. That was one option. Another option was resect the liver metastasis first, and then in stage, go back 6 or 8 weeks later and take the primary, also viable. It was resectable, so we didn't need the chemotherapy to lead to substantial reduction to make it resectable. But the sort of other approach was to give chemotherapy really as a bioassay to make sure that cure was really the goal in this patient. The role of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in resectable patients is as much to get a sense of the tempo of the disease and its biology as it is to get tumor reduction.
Does that really play out in your own practice? I mean, do you see that, for example, just giving a couple of doses or treatments like that, some patients who actually end up developing progressive disease?
Absolutely. And just last month, we had a young patient who we did this on and had numerous lung metastases at the next imaging. This was a patient who wouldn't have benefited from a major hepatic resection. Certainly, the downside is if you get morbidity or complications of the chemotherapy, you may wish that you hadn't done that. It's a gamble any way you go.
There's also been the issue about, when you say complications, I guess the impact of chemotherapy on the liver. What do we know about that?
Right. So there is something called CASH, chemotherapy-associated steatohepatitis, which is possibly more related to a irinotecan-based therapy than oxaliplatin, but there is liver injury with any of these chemotherapies. And in this patient, or in any patient, if you believe surgical resection of liver metastases is appropriate, we limit the exposure to systemic chemotherapy. So a surgeon who sees this patient and sends them to the medical oncologist for upfront chemotherapy wants to see that patient back after no more than 3 or 4 cycles. And if they're going to go to surgery, then you stop the chemotherapy. It does appear to be a cumulative effect on the liver, and so-called blue liver is friable. There's a lot of blood loss. It can be a mess and really increase the morbidity and complications of surgery.
So what happened with this patient?
Well, this patient actually is going to go to hepatic resection in the next couple of weeks. The patient got 4 cycles of FOLFIRI by itself without bevacizumab.
And can you explain what FOLFIRI is?
FOLFIRI is 5-FU leucovorin and irinotecan. This patient, the rationale, FOLFIRI is equal almost certainly in every way to FOLFOX, that's oxaliplatin with 5-FU leucovorin. FOLFOX is useful and is used in the adjuvant setting. FOLFIRI is not, but for advanced disease, they're both about as effective. The problem with FOLFOX is it can cause neuropathy, which can be marked and problematic, although usually it's related to exposure of 7 or 8 doses. In this patient, though, we gave FOLFIRI just for 4 doses, he had a major reduction of the tumor in the liver. We are just doing a colonoscopy now, but the plan will be to resect his liver and then follow that up with resection of the primary. He cruised. He didn't miss a beat. Happily, he had no trouble with the chemotherapy. The one other point to make is that the primary frequently all but disappears in these patients. We see again and again that patients with synchronous metastatic disease and primaries in place, we actually are to the point of marking the primary site or having the surgeon scope the patient before chemotherapy because it's not unusual for the primary to either disappear or to dramatically be reduced by the chemotherapy.
There was a really fascinating paper presented from Memorial at the recent ASCO meeting looking at a case series of people who had a primary, I think, colon and rectal cancer and metastatic disease where they tried to manage these people without surgery. Can you talk about that?
Right. So by and large, what they found is that it was unusual for the patients to need surgery or emergent surgery if they were treated with chemotherapy first.
And I guess we should qualify that these people had asymptomatic primaries.
That's correct. So the patient with obstruction or marked bleeding wasn't included in this study. And the bottom line is it's unusual. This was a retrospective look. So there are some biases, and the ascertainment of patients may be questionable. But in terms of the take-home message, it's unusual for patients to require emergent surgery while they're getting the chemotherapy. And it certainly supports the notion that, as opposed to 5 years ago when all of these patients would get their primaries resected, this supports the notion that we can wait. There is a prospective study, NSABP-C10, that is taking patients like this, asymptomatic primaries and metastatic disease, and treating patients with FOLFOX plus Avastin and looking to see the risk of bowel complications, of need for emergent surgery. And so far, at least as been reported preliminarily, it's a rare patient who gets into trouble with that approach.
I think this is a really great study and a concept for patients. I mean, it's really tragic when people die of this disease, but if they can avoid going through a major surgical procedure from a quality of life point of view, that's a pretty positive thing.
Absolutely. And the other value here is that in some patients with marginally curable disease, where if chemotherapy really is extremely active, you may make a big difference. If you do surgery, you're going to delay chemotherapy by 4 to 6 weeks. It's conceivable that some patients, that 4 to 6 week period is an important time frame that you'd like to get the chemotherapy started. It's a change in paradigm, though, and to be honest, many colorectal surgeons, it's not unusual for us to get an email or a call from a family or a patient. They'd like to be seen. They have a metastatic disease and a primary, just saw the colorectal surgeon today, and they want to do surgery in 2 days. And for the asymptomatic patient, I think it's just not necessary to do such urgent surgery, and again, may not be the right step.
You know, we had a renal cell cancer think tank of investigators here a few weeks ago, and I was telling them about this colon study because, you know, in renal, you have this concept that it was the way colon was until a few years ago where, you know, people present with metastatic disease, you take their kidney out, but I couldn't convince them of this as a possibility.
Yeah, well, the kidney cancer has this aura of the immune system.
Right.
And it may be true, it may not, but it's a constant issue that primaries being taken out improves outcome for patients.
Right.
I don't know the field well enough, but in colon cancer, clearly we've flipped the paradigm upside down with the newer chemotherapy and these kinds of studies.
Well, also, they were saying that it's not that common to have an asymptomatic primary, and I guess in colon cancer, it's not uncommon.
Very common. Probably 50 or 60% is my guess are asymptomatic, even with probing and careful questioning. It's a really surprisingly common scenario.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of KRAS testing in colorectal cancer, specifically as it relates to the use of panitumumab and cetuximab?
KRAS, of course, is one of many oncogenes and one of the many mutations in tumor cells that we've identified as being important in the way colon cancer evolves. It's also very prominent in pancreas cancer and a few other cancers for sure. What's relevant about KRAS and colon cancer is that the pathway of KRAS, the RAS pathway, is downstream of the epidermal growth factor receptor. And one of the newer modalities, newer pathways that we treat colon cancer patients with are inhibitors of the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway. There are two of them, two antibodies. One is cetuximab, also known as Erbitux. The other is panitumumab, also known as Vectibix. And really now on the strength of numerous retrospective analyses, it's clear that tumors that have mutations of the KRAS gene, those patients do not get any benefit from either cetuximab or panitumumab. if their genes are wild type doesn't mean they will necessarily benefit from these inhibitors, but it's clear that they won't benefit if they're mutations. So it's been our practice for the last year and a half or so, since this data has sort of become sufficient, we think, it's been our practice only to offer these antibody treatments to patients with KRAS wild-type tumors. And just in the last week, I believe, the FDA added it to the label. So now this KRAS analysis needs to be done to determine suitability for these drugs. The analysis can be done on the primary tumor. There is almost perfect concordance with KRAS mutational status between primary and metastatic disease. There's even evolving data that a second marker in KRAS wild-type patients further defines a subset who will or won't benefit, and that's called the BRAF gene, a mutation in BRAF. This, again, gets back to the individualized therapy and sorting out either who will or won't benefit from a variety of these treatments. We're actually now of the belief, because the time frame and the decision-making process, when we see a patient with metastatic disease, we immediately send off a tumor block, the slides for KRAS analysis to start sorting through what the options are.
You know, you hear all these pathways and these markers and you kind of go, oh yeah, what does this really mean? But then, wow, there was a spectacular presentation at ASCO on a BRAF inhibitor in melanoma, and they saw some fantastic responses. I guess that's going to be looked at in colon now?
Correct. It is fascinating that part of the reality that's setting in is that these pathways are of different importance in different diseases. And the blatant example, of course, is c-KIT or BCR-ABL in GI stromal tumor or chronic myelogenous leukemia, where interference with one pathway can make a world of difference to patients. And as you said, this BRAF inhibitor, it appears in a subset of melanoma patients to be very important. There are other fascinating examples. The hedgehog inhibitors, this is a new class of drugs, appear to work amazingly well in basal cell carcinoma. So I think as we expand our knowledge base, a lot of stuff is confusing, but occasionally you just pick out dramatic examples of how to treat diseases, and that's a good one.